Look, humor me for a minute. I'm going to say he's risen. This is really old school. And the response is, and like our church is really awkward to this stuff, but you're meant to respond, he is risen indeed. So let's give it a go. He is risen. Oh, love it. That's like just an old school thing that I remember we grew up, that's how we responded. Now, I don't know if you know much about the resurrection, but a guy called, who was an apostle, sent one from Jesus, a guy called Paul, writing not long after the events of the first Easter, close to 2,000 years ago, said this about the resurrection, about Jesus rising from the grave. This is what he says. Writing to a church, he says, "If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our proclamation is in vain. And so is your faith. Moreover, we are found to be false witnesses about God." He then later goes on to say that if the resurrection didn't happen, if we have put our hope in Christ for this life only, we should be pitied more than anyone. In other words, if the resurrection didn't happen, this is a waste of time. What we tell you is a lie, and what we believe is a lie, and you should legit feel sorry for us. You should. I would actually tell you to run. So if none of this happened, I would tell you, run, get out. This is really, really, really stupid. Even Richard Dawkins, so the famous scientist and atheist, when he was debating John Lennox, another famous scientist but a Christian, he said this in his concluding remarks as he was debating John Lennox. He says, "It all quite really comes down to the resurrection of Jesus. It has a fundamental incompatibility with a sophisticated scientist. It's so petty, so trivial, so local, it's so earthbound, it's so unworthy of the universe." Now, if the resurrection didn't happen, I'd agree with him. But this is why we're here. Because if this did happen, it changes everything. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you three quick historical facts that are hard to know. So regardless of whether you're a skeptic that, you know, likes to just think this is a joke, or you're a believer, three quick facts to help us sort of get into it. Firstly, Jesus died and the tomb was empty. Jesus died and the tomb was empty. We have, historically speaking, multiple independent and early accounts that this is the case. You can read and examine it for yourselves, regardless of your beliefs. In terms of death, the Romans were really good at it. And in terms of checking if people are dead, they were pretty, very, very adamant at making sure that was the case. But you can also check multiple sources, some found in what we call the New Testament, which is found in the Bible. Now, you might go, "Oh, isn't that Bible really biased?" Any historical document, anything you write or we write, has a certain bias. That doesn't make it any less or more true. It does require you then to examine what is being said and what has been put before us. So we're doing that right now. We're looking at the gospel account found in Mark, one of the earliest accounts we have of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. But this fact, hard to miss, Jesus died, he was dead. Everyone, historically speaking, agrees on that. And two, that the tomb was empty. Now, how did the tomb become empty is another matter. Like, you know, we can go, "Oh, it was because of this, this or that." But for now, understand that most, I would say all, but there are always those weird people who, in the historian field, that like to not believe things, but most historians believe this. But let me read part of the account together found in Mark, verse 1. This is what it says. "When the Sabbath, a Sunday, was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so that they could go and anoint him, Jesus. Very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb at sunrise. They were saying to one another, 'Who will roll away this stone from the entrance to the tomb for us?' Looking up, they noticed that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. When they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in white robes sitting on the right side. They were alarmed. 'Don't be alarmed,' he told them. 'You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they put him. In the recent invasion of Ukraine from Russia, there's been this really interesting phenomenon, if you followed the news, that in a time and age we were so connected, so quick with information, it has actually been really hard at times to determine fact from fiction at times. Both Russian and Ukrainian governments and medias claim different facts. Russia says it's just a military exercise. Ukraine go, no, they invaded us. Videos posted online are claimed by different people to represent different things. An expert on the radio recently said that there is so much information just going out from the country that it's actually really hard to put everything together straight away. It's actually going to take some time to unpack. My point is this. Evidence needs to be examined, scrutinized, and put to the test. I'm going to argue that the resurrection has been examined, scrutinized, and put to the test for close to 2,000 years, and it's still compelling today. It has stood the test of time, if you like. And now you can come up with all sorts of counter theories, just like the Russians have with every Ukrainian sort of claim and vice versa. But we now have the strength of hindsight, the ability to look back and see what has happened since. Either way, this morning, if you're a skeptic, let me challenge you. And if you're a follower of Jesus, then can I encourage you? He is risen. Second historical fact that you can't deny, whether you don't believe that fact or not, is that in these records, there are many accounts of people seeing Jesus alive again. There were close to 500 initially and then more. And some of these accounts were written while those witnesses were still alive, so that they could have easily said, actually, that didn't happen. They could have denied it. They could have checked it and said, no. Again, you can come up with all sorts of theories to make sense of it. Maybe they had such grief that all these people hallucinated together. Sure, that hasn't really happened historically, but sure. You can come up with all these type of things. But historically speaking, it was hard to deny that people witnessed, saw, touched, ate with Jesus of Nazareth. He is risen. Third historical account, and this is a really interesting one, is you've got to account for the rise of Christianity. It should not have gotten off the ground in this period of time and lasted the way it has lasted. By all accounts, the followers of Jesus abandoned him when he was crucified and buried. They were cowardly. They were afraid. Yet something happened back then in that first century, at that very first Easter, that made those early Christians reason to tell others about him, despite their fears and insecurities. The Romans didn't want this to take flight. The Jewish nation didn't want Jesus to be proclaimed. And despite all of that, men, women died so that the news of Jesus could go out. So what happened? What happened that made, if you look at any movement in history, once the leader dies, it dies out so often, especially when everything is against it. And in the first century, when it was just a minority, no one knew or heard about Jesus. What changed? Again, I said you can come up with all sorts of theories and we can be here till the cows come home, which I just learned the other day. Cows don't come home. I didn't realize that. We have a vet. Yeah, anyway, you told me. So let me approach this a different way. So, because I can present those facts and go, there's this, that. But I think there are ways in which we can examine the truth and its implications. And I want to sort of put, a different sort of spin on it for a moment. Not twist anything, just I want to give you some more compelling reasons. Like when it comes to my children, I tell them, eat vegetables. Now, I can tell them all the good minerals and the health sort of benefits from eating. That does not convince them to eat vegetables, unless you give them a compelling reason for it. And so, look, I'm going to try to do that now Because I reckon the third historical point confronts me the most, that Christianity exploded. That because the disciples, the followers, preachers, mums, dads, missionaries and kids believe what happened on that very first Easter, this movement that unites people from all tongues, tribes and nations, the most multicultural movement in the world, is now alive and living and breathing, and it's a beautiful, wondrous thing. I want to give you some compelling reasons to why that is. And because I'm a preacher, I'm just going to do three quick reasons. I'm going to all start with D, because that's just how we do it. Look, death, desires, destination. Those three compelling reasons I want to quickly give to you, because I really actually want to get to the baptisms, because that's really, for me, the application of this. But let's start with death. Death, look, you might find this a bit weird and morbid. When I was young, I always had this strange fascination with horror films. I hate being scared. I don't like the feeling, even when I watch them as an adult, of how paranoid I get walking down the house at night after I watch one. But I always had a fascination. Don't know why, it's just there. But here's my reflection. What is the ultimate horror in any of these stories? My observation has been, it's death, isn't it? I mean, you can get all sorts of weird things. Everyone rides and hides from all sorts of weird and wacky stuff. But they run and they hide because what they're scared of ultimately is death. Because I'm going to argue that is the ultimate horror for us as human beings. Death and what it means. And death has reigned king for most of human history. Make no mistake. I mean, you tell me one person who has avoided it, conquered it, has just been able to just prolong life long enough to never taste it. Not one. But there is a person that we claim has. You think of every heartache most of us feel and the loss of loved ones. Like the reality of death, if you haven't tasted or hasn't affected you or your life or your family before, there is a day coming where it will. Death is at the door. It is the horror of every story. I don't care whether you're like, oh, look, I'm a staunch atheist. Death, the reality of it, the implications of it, what it means, is so much more than just, oh, yeah, that's just natural circle of life part of thing. It hits, and it hits in a way that, look, I've lost too many people I love, and I know it won't be the end. And if you've tasted that grief, then you understand why death is so confronting and what it means when someone has conquered it. What made those early disciples and followers stand before kings, governors, and courts without the fear of death is because they witnessed, they touched, they ate with the one who'd conquered it. They knew the one who is the resurrection and the life, and it changes everything. Death does not have the final say. There is more to this story than decaying, random, meaningless atoms. If death is defeated, this means the way we invest in our children, our future, our own lives changes. But I think if there's someone who's conquered, someone who's defeated, that's a compelling reason to at least listen to what that may mean. It's worth at least going, okay, one day I will be at death's door, and regardless of what you believe, if there's someone who's come back from the dead, and you go, oh, I don't know if they're right, examine it, because if they're true, it means so much more. Which leads me to the second point, desires. Because one could argue that the reason this story is so compelling is because we are afraid of the dark, afraid of death. Because we're afraid of death, we've come up with some sort of narrative to cope with this reality. Sure, you could say that. But I think it just fails to grasp the complex gambit of what we're talking about. In other words, it's too easy to just say that. Oh, you just came up with that because you wanted to believe. Yeah, but why is it that we're so scared of death? If it's so, like, it's the reality we face for since the beginning of life, it seems. Why can't we get over it? Why do we still wrestle with it? Why do we say, even if you don't believe in Jesus, still tell them, oh, your grandma or mom or dad or brother or sister, they've gone to a really nice place. Why can't we just settle with it and just go, oh, look, it's all meaningless. It's all just dark, pitiless indifference. Let me put it this way. Why do you feel hunger? Why do you crave relationships? Why do you seek fun and play? Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction of those desires exists. In other words, a child hungers for food because food exists. We hunger for relationship with one another because people exist. We hunger for pleasure because pleasure exists. And I could go on and on. But desires can be a witness of sorts. And I think the universal human fear of death and the desire for something more or some sort of meaning to life testifies to this. Now you go, oh, whatever, like I'm just facts and figures. But none of you live on that premise alone. Like you go on the road, facts and figures, right? You drive on the road, you go 50, the person going 40, how do you feel? Does your desire go, oh, they're just going 40. Oh, that's good for them, isn't it? No, your desires flare up. I'm sure. Maybe you're a lot more nice than I am. Our desires are a witness of sorts. And a cat more sort of smarter than me, put it in a much elegant way, a guy called C.S. Lewis, famous writer, English lecturer, academic, put it said this way. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only arouse it to suggest the real thing. In other words, if all that we go through in life means something, points to something, then there is a greater reality. Because why isn't our career enough? Why isn't our family enough? Why isn't love, pleasure, money? Why can we never have enough of it and just be satisfied with it? I'm going to argue because we were made for something more. We were created with a desire, that, like a sort of limitless, eternal desire. Because the one who put it there is eternal and limitless. Death is not the end. The reason we crave something more, the reason we fear it, because we know it's an intruder. We know that this shouldn't be the reality, even though we accept it. And here Jesus proves in one of the most vivid ways that there is more to life than we see. He affirms that this life was a taste of something better to come. Even in its brokenness, the desire for justice or healing and hope, all of those things point to a greater reality that justice does and should exist. Healing should exist. There is a way in which life should function. Which leads me to my last point. Destination. What if our heart's desires, that eternal pit, that of just like, if our heart's desires something so eternal, as C.S. Lewis, that it's made for something more. I think it just echoes something that's quite essential about our human life, that what is it that we can't quite put our finger on in our lives that's just dissatisfying? Is there anyone that can sort of address it? I'm going to say it's like that desire, I don't know if you've ever had it, when you've been out for a long day or you've traveled for a long while, that desire to be home. You may have not, but I'm an extrovert. I love being out, but there are days when I've just been out talking to people all day and I just crave home. Just that desire to be at rest. And if you think about what makes a true home home, like can I say it's a true home is more than just brick and mortar, plaster and the deco and gadgets, isn't it? So often it's the people that you share it with. So often it's a safe place in which you can retreat and be yourself. I'm not going to argue that God has sort of created that desire for home, that desire, that longing for something, because we were meant to make our home in Him. Relationship makes home home. So God dying on the cross for our sins, and Jesus taking away God's wrath in our place and rising 3 days later was to open this reality for us. He was going to restore what we couldn't, to bring back together what we had pulled apart. And He was going to do it in such a compelling, beautiful way that it wasn't just like, I've paid for death, I've paid the price, now just go, live your life. So different to that. He paid the price and then He draws us in. Come, enjoy, taste and see that the Lord is good. That death no longer has a hold on us. That there is something more compelling about life than the things we just muck around with. That actually the things that we muck around with in life actually point to something more sweeter and beautiful. It's a home with the Creator. Like when a child is held by a mother or a friend comforted by another friend. It's in those moments when we feel that connection, that harmony, that beautiful melody when everything seems to be aligned. It's just a taste of what God is offering us. Every earthly imitation is just that, because it's meant to point us to this eternal reality, relationship with God. The one who truly loves us, restores us, saves us, and satisfies us. It's why the last book of the Bible, if you've ever read it, has these powerful words spoken by Jesus. He says, the one seated on the throne, Jesus said, look, I'm making everything new. He also said, write, because these words are faithful and true. See, for us, this is no fantasy. Christianity isn't about fairy tales or clocking your mind out when you come in. The evidence has to be given. There needs to be a compelling reason for us being here. You should examine what we say. That's why we ask you to text in your questions. You might not be able to answer everything, but you should be able to give an account. God actually gives us a commandment to love Him with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind. We're meant to engage our minds. But understand this, we are left with a choice. What do we do with it? This is exactly how the book of Mark actually ends, this gospel account, this biography of Jesus' life. In light of who Jesus is and what He's done, what will you do? It ends in a cliffhanger. Look, read with me. After the women encounter the sort of angel in the tomb, listen to what happens. The angel says, don't be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. He was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they put Him. But go, tell His disciples and Peter. He's going ahead of you to Galilee. You will see him there just as He told you. They went out and ran from the tomb, because trembling and astonishment overwhelmed them. And they said nothing to anyone, since they were afraid. That's actually how the book ends. And you're like, whoa, what happened? How does this thing end? Over 2,000 years ago, with close to a billion followers, how it ends is that these women actually tell people what had happened. They go and tell the disciples and Peter, who funnily enough don't actually believe them. Like, they come and say, you know how Jesus said He was going to rise from the grave? Well, we went there. He's not there. We just got told He's risen. They're like, oh, wait a minute. No, let's go. They go, they check, they examine. They go, oh, it's really weird. He's not there. And they go back home, not believing. So what changes? What makes this movement explode? What makes people from different tribes, tongues, and nations celebrate this event all over the world? That Jesus is King and that He is risen. It's because it happened. And if it happened, death no longer has a hold. Our desires for something more can be satisfied. And our destination, this is not all there is, that there is something better coming. He will make all things new. So what are you going to do? You can celebrate it, you can investigate it, or you can reject it. But today, with us, unfortunately, if you want to just reject it, you're going to have to celebrate with us for a little bit. Because we see in another vivid way what it actually means for us to follow Jesus. And we're going to see that displayed in a minute. I'm going to pray, I'm going to sing a song, and I'm going to come back together to have a few baptisms. So join with me in prayer.